If you are looking to elevate your leadership and drive your nonprofit forward, I invite you to subscribe to the Successful Nonprofits newsletter. Every week, I curate exclusive, shareworthy content that sparks inspiration, innovation, and conversation. From the latest trends to timeless advice, the weekly email newsletter is your all-access pass to a treasure trove of resources. But receiving the newsletter is not just about staying informed. It's also about getting our best content first. Subscribers get first access to our newest downloadable templates designed to propel your leadership and amplify your impact. And that's not all, my friend. We are constantly working on new ways to support you and your mission. So as a subscriber, you'll get updates on our latest projects, opportunities to participate in surveys, and a say in the topics that we tackle next. You will essentially get me as a consultant, coach, and confidant in your inbox, ready to help you navigate the challenges of nonprofit leadership. So if you're an executive director, board chair, or a nonprofit leader who believes in making a difference, join me as a newsletter subscriber. Visit successfulnonprofits.com/newsletter to sign up today. And now, friend, let me take you to the episode you've downloaded. Welcome to the Successful Nonprofits Podcast. I'm your host, Dolph Goldenberg. Guess what, friends? Today is another mailbag episode, and that means that Lexi and I are going to be on talking about some questions that we get from clients, prospective clients, people who are never going to be clients but still send us a question. And by the way, all of these questions we've already responded to in some way, either we've replied by email or set up a Zoom call or something like that. So we encourage everybody's questions. Lexi, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dolph. I'm happy to be back.
And I know you're going to curate some great questions for us today.
So as you said, we answer everybody's questions, but there's a few that we tend to hear a lot. And so I've got a couple ready for you.
All right, let's hit them.
All right. Well, my first two both have to do with staff. And I think this is something, again, we're hearing a lot about these days. So I'm really excited to ask you and hear your response. So the first one of my paid staff members is asking to join our board. Is that okay?
Okay, Lexi, before I answer that question, is there a short answer that you think I'm going to give?
Oh, yeah. Would you like to hear it?
I was like, really? You think I'm going to say, oh, yeah. All right. Yeah.
Oh, no. So, you have a short answer.
You want me to tell you? Yeah.
Here's your answer. No.
You win the prize. I don't know what your prize is going to be yet. I'll figure it out by the end of the episode, and you know I'll really send it to you. You win a prize. So yes, the answer is no. The only paid staff member who can be a member of the board is your executive director or your chief executive. That is the same position, let me be clear. But you know, your executive director, or their title might be chief executive, managing director, or something like that. And that is the only person. And honestly, I don't even recommend that that person be a voting board member. So if your board decides to allow your chief executive or your executive director to serve on the board, I don't even recommend it's a best practice to have them be a board member. Here's why it is a tragic mistake to make another staff member a board member. Presumably, that staff member reports to the executive director. Now, imagine some weird world in which you are your parent and you are also your child. Now imagine a weird world where you are your boss and you are also your boss's boss. Doesn't work out so well. Imagine there's a performance issue and you have to discipline someone who's on your board. You're not going to. Now imagine other staff members are having issues, or maybe clients are having issues with you as the chief executive, or community members are having issues with you as the chief executive. Who are they going to go to first if they don't want to go to you? They're going to go to your staff member who's also on the board. They're going to think, oh, I'm going to have an ally there. So don't, please do not make that mistake. Do not allow a staff member to be on the board. And I will share with you from my perspective, that would be a deal breaker. If I had a board that said to me, Dolph, we really want to get this staff person on our board, my answer would be You know, I know that I don't have a vote in who's going to be on the board, and I don't have a veto unless it's a staff member. I do get to decide what our staff members do in relation to this organization, and the answer is no. And that is a hill that I would be willing to die on.
I like your long answer.
Yeah, I know that. I was going to say, I know that's a short answer, but you happy with that answer?
Mm-hmm.
Did I leave anything out?
I think the only other thing we've talked about is that board members are also expected to volunteer. They're expected to donate. And that can get a little complicated when you're asking a staff member to do those things as well. So beyond just a crazy org chart you're creating and all of the issues that can come up from that, you know, there's potentially other issues that can come up just by the nature of board work and the nature of being an employee of an organization.
Agreed. Absolutely. That's an excellent point.
All right. My next staff question. This is another one we've been hearing a lot lately, especially these days. I have a staff member with a bad attitude. She can be difficult for other staff to work with. And sometimes she brings that bad attitude to meetings with partners, board members, etc. But I'm nervous to lay her off because it's so hard to hire right now, and I don't want to lower morale among other staff or possibly risk other staff leaving because of it.
Frankly, Lexi, this is a question. You're right. We get this question. We've gotten this question a good little bit over the last couple of years. And this is a question I kind of struggle with, because I think the first thing to do as the manager or the leader is to check yourself and, you know, really, really try to determine, is this implicit bias on my part? You know, there are times where if one person does something, you don't view that as a bad attitude, but someone else does it and you do view it as a bad attitude. And so the first thing that I would ask is, if any of your staff members, if your favorite team member did this, would you say that person has a bad attitude? And really, really, really dive deep there before you take this any further. Assuming you look at this and you say to yourself, you know, my favorite team member actually did this and I had to have a difficult conversation with that person and say, this is not okay, here's why. Then go ahead and proceed and start to move forward. Well, I think what's really critical though is if you believe an employee has a bad attitude, that when you sit down and have that conversation with the person, it's not you have a bad attitude. It's not, well, the way you approach your work seems to indicate you have a bad attitude. That's really amorphous. What is a bad attitude to one person is, hey, I am sticking up for myself to another person. Or, hey, I'm just doing what's right. I'm saying what no one else is willing to say. I'm speaking the truth to another person. And so that's why I would really encourage you to distill it down to very specific behaviors. Hey, in meetings, sometimes you're pounding your hand on the table and you're raising your voice to the level of a yell and telling a colleague that she's wrong. That's behavior. And that you can say, look, behavior that's like that is not okay. And you can performance manage behavior. To me, though, just going to someone and saying, hey, you've got a bad attitude, it's kind of like, you know, I don't know, if you hire a graphic designer and maybe it's to do an invitation for your big gala. And the first draft the graphic designer shows you, like, I don't like it. And the graphic designer says, okay, why not? And you say, it's too colorful. And the graphic designer goes, do you want black and white? No, but this one, it's too colorful. That's not enough for the graphic designer to really go on. You need to be very specific. Hey, you know, we're going for a classical theme. This is a modern theme. We're trying to keep it down to our brand colors. We only have 4 brand colors. We don't have 12 brand colors. Making it very concrete and very specific. And we do the same thing for people that are having behavioral issues, because attitude in and by itself is not the problem. It's the way in which the behavior is exhibiting and is interrupting your organization's ability to perform and your team members' ability to perform. And so boil it down, make that list. Hey, here are the 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 behaviors that I'm seeing. I'd encourage you not to make it a laundry list of 100. What I would think about is, you know, really get it down to, frankly, a list of 4 or 5 tops and making it concrete, but also making it inclusive enough that if you did have 100, they would fit inside one of those 4 or 5. And again, from there, you can performance manage the same way you would an employee who's tardy, an employee who's not completing work on time, the exact same way. Lexi, thoughts?
Oh, yeah, I agree with what you've said. I am curious what you think for staff where, you know, if you've done that and the issue's not resolving and it's continuing and perhaps getting worse, what your thoughts are in terms of hanging on to that person, even though at this point they're not putting in an effort, possibly not a good fit, and you know, what that might be doing to an organization's morale.
Great question. What I would think about is something that I gained from a book called Discipline Without Punishment. And before I talk about it, let me remind my friends that I don't do legal counsel. You need to make sure that if you're going to do anything that could be construed as disciplining an employee, you need to make sure that it's consistent with state and federal law. You need to make sure that it's consistent with your own policies and procedures, et cetera. But I have found it very useful if I have counseled a staff member, documented the counseling around what the expectations are. Because again, around behavior, we can set expectations. So, you know, really counsel the employee about what the expectations are, have received the commitment multiple times from the employee that they're going to adhere to that expectation. That's when I reach the point of doing what Discipline Without Punishment calls a decision-making leave. And that's where I will say to the person, and by the way, I never provide a decision-making leave on a Monday or a Friday because it should not be a long weekend. I will normally do it on a Wednesday. And I normally will tell the person the day before, typically about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'll say, you know, we've been working with you around this behavior. I'm still seeing it. In fact, I saw it yesterday in the following way. I thought that we had a commitment from you that this behavior was going to end. And that's based on the following times that we've talked about it where you've committed that this behavior is going to end. So again, what you're hearing is this is very fact. Like, this is not what I'd say to the person. I'm saying this to you, my friends who are listening. This is very factual. This is when we talked about it. And then saying to the person, that's why I am going to give you, I'd not put you on, I am going to give you a 1 day paid decision-making leave. You are still at work, but you're just not going to come in and you're not going to do any of your usual work. In fact, we're going to lock you out of all of your systems in the next 30 minutes. And what I want you to do tomorrow is spend the entire workday thinking about whether or not this job is the right fit for you, thinking about whether or not you are planning to stay. And that means this behavior will end. When you come back into work on Thursday morning, you and I are going to meet first thing Thursday morning. Our day starts at 8:30, so we're going to meet at 8:30. And my expectation is that you're either going to come in and you're going to say to me, Dolph, I understand what my behavior needs to be. I want to be here at this organization, and my behavior will be in line with the expectations that have been set, which are, and then I would define whatever those are. I will be on time. I will turn my assignments in on time. And in case of a bad attitude, you know, I won't pound the table in meetings and scream at my colleagues, whatever those expectations are. Or you can come in and say, Dolph, I realized that I don't want to be here because I'm not willing to live within the expectations that are set. Or you could just come in and say, I don't want to be here because I don't like you, whatever. You could come up with any reason why you don't want to be here, right? But those are the only two options. Not, I'd like to stay if. Either I want to stay and I'm going to meet the expectations, or I'm going to leave. I will also say, when I am giving someone that decision-making leave, I will also say to them that when they come back on Thursday morning is the last time we're going to talk about this. If that behavior occurs again, there isn't a warning. There isn't an additional write-up. Everything's been well documented up to this point. It's just a termination. So, Lexi, what I have found when I give someone a decision-making leave, about 95% of the time, they come back and say, I'm in, I'm all in, I'm going to meet the expectations. But about 60% of the time, they actually do, and the behavior's corrected. About 40% of the time, sometime in the next month to 6 weeks, I actually have to terminate them. But I phrased that wrong because, in fact, I didn't terminate them. They knew the situation under which they would be losing their job, and they're the ones that ultimately made that decision.
Yeah. I also want to reflect that in a few cases where we've had clients put in this position, and that staff member has left for whichever reason, they've actually found that morale has improved and they were able to replace that person and find someone who was a better fit, and that ultimately the organization came out stronger for it. And making sure, you know, that they have the behavior that they need is essential. Yeah.
And I would agree with you. And I think in a lot of those cases, there was some short-term fallout. You know, someone left angry and they were going to do as much damage as they could, but they were going to leave angry at some point, no matter what.
Right.
Even if they quit, they were going to leave angry. So it's kind of like, you know, do I want short-term fallout, but not have this long-term period of low-level pain? Or do I want low-level pain for years and years and years and let it infect my entire organization?
Which is really damaging. Mm-hmm. Over time. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You ready for a different question and a different topic? We'll get off our staff woes.
Absolutely. Let's jump to another topic.
All right. This comes from a podcast listener as well. I was listening to the podcast episode, Podcasting for Nonprofits. I was thinking about starting a podcast for my nonprofit and wondering if you have any resources as far as equipment to buy when starting.
You know, I've committed to not saying the name of any organization, so I won't say the name of this organization, but I did check out your organization online. What a really super cool organization. And I'm so glad you all are thinking about starting a podcast. I have said this, I say this all the time. I believe every nonprofit should have their own podcast. If you want to connect with your audience, if you want to connect with your people, if you want to get your story out consistently in the way that you want your story out, you should have a podcast. If you want to find a great way to cultivate donors, imagine being able to, you know, have on a major donor who talks about why she loves your organization so much and, you know, why she commits year after year. She's going to feel great about it. And guess what? You're now encouraging other people to do the exact same thing. Or imagine getting to sit down with a conversation with the mayor of your city and talk about the issues that are impacting the people you serve. Wow, you're going to move the needle. Like from a policy perspective, you're also really going to elevate your status within the communities of people you serve and within the communities of providers who serve those same clients as you do. Because they're going to be like, wow, this is an organization that the mayor sits down with. Funders are going to take notice of that too. So I believe every single organization should have its own podcast. I'm glad that you're doing that. So I think you asked for a short list, and Lexi, now it's like I'm actually talking to the person. I think the person asked for a short list of equipment.
Yes.
Okay. So I think in order for you to do this well, you need to spend about $200 to $250 on equipment. And so the first thing you want to do is you want to buy a microphone. Lexi, you and I use the Blue Yeti. I've also used some Rodes. I'll share with you, my Rodes microphone actually broke after about 2 years and was twice the price of my Yeti. My Yeti, I fold it up, I throw it in my bag. I can record stuff anywhere in the world that I am. And it's so far, I've had it for, I guess, 6 years, and it's been a super, super durable, not terribly expensive, on sale about $100, but I wouldn't wait for a sale because, you know, you don't want your sound quality to be bad to save $25. So you'll probably pay $125, $150 for that. Now, your Blue Yeti is not going to come with a pop shield, so I'd suggest that you buy a pop shield. Now, I just realized I'm talking jargon. Lexi, I'm going to ask you, can you explain what a pop shield is?
Is that my little cover over my microphone?
Yep, exactly. And here's what I'm going to do. So a pop is the P sound, and it kind of sounds like an explosion when you don't use a pop shield. Now, sometimes the pop shield, depending on the mic, my pop shield is like a foam cover. Sometimes it's like a cloth disc. You're going to hear some noise. I'm going to take my pop shield off. Peter Piper pecked a pick of pickled peppers. Yeah, that was painful. I'm sorry, friends. I know that was painful. Now I just put my pop shield back on and Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers. You might still hear some pee, but not nearly as much. If you heard that loud, explosive pee, you wouldn't listen to the podcast. So spend the 10, 15 bucks, buy a pop shield on Amazon. I would not buy it from Blue Yeti. I'd save the money. Also, you want some padding for the area that you're recording in. Lexi, I know you and I just talked about this because you moved into a beautiful new home, but we had an issue when we did our sound check. Can you talk about that?
Oh, it was very echoey. I could even hear it bouncing back into my own headphones. So for my temporary solution, because this is the first time we're recording in this house, I had to go pull all the pillows off my bed and I've created a wall on three sides of me, pillows.
And I will say that works. We often have podcast guests where we do a sound check ahead of time and it just sounds so echoey. And I'll be like, do you have some couch pillows anywhere nearby? And in some cases, they're in a corporate office and they'll say in the waiting room, I'm like, can you go get them? And they're like, I feel weird about that. And I have to say to them, people aren't going to listen to the audio unless you go and get them. So then they'll go to the waiting room and explain to the receptionist why they're removing all of the pillows from the waiting room. There's some more elegant solutions, but the quick fix is just some pillows from a bed or throw pillows or something like that.
I do think, though, real quick, Dolph, if you're going to be hosting the podcast, it is worth investing a little bit and making your space comfortable. Because I'll admit, I'm kind of leaned over a little bit. If I was regularly recording podcasts, this would not be sustainable for me. So make your space comfy and just invest in it.
And I agree with you. I have, when I first started podcasting, I was podcasting from my home office, which, and the audio quality, I've talked a lot about the fact I did not invest in audio quality early. And consequently, we have about 50 or 55 episodes of the podcast we don't publicly run anymore, just because the audio quality is so bad. Eventually, I finally invested in some of the things that I'm talking about now. But I'll share with you, early on, it was very echoey. And then we moved and I ended up in a closet, and so I tried to pad a closet a little bit. Eventually, we bought a house with a large enough closet that I've essentially turned into a recording studio. And even then, I didn't spend a fortune. I spent a few hundred dollars on materials because I built it all myself. I did price it out, and I thought to myself, I'm not going to spend $5,000 on this. So instead, I looked at some YouTube videos about how to build a recording studio for a few hundred dollars, and that's what I did. So, you know, so you don't have to spend thousands. A few hundred dollars will take you a long, long way. And then the last is some recording software. I've fallen in love with Audio Hijack. It's not terribly expensive. By the way, it's not software as a service, so you're not going to be paying monthly or even annually. Literally, like you pay, you download the app. Where they do get you, though, is every now and then they'll do a big update. And when they do that big update, they'll say, oh, this update is so big that you have to upgrade and then you'll spend $10 or $20 to upgrade. But that's once every few years. So those are the things I'd recommend. A Blue Yeti mic, a pop shield, some kind of padding for the area so that you're absorbing the echo. And then, of course, decent recording software like Audio Hijack. All in, I think you're probably going to spend about $200, maybe $250. Lexi, other thoughts about equipment this person should have?
No, I think you hit on all of it.
And then the only other thing I will share with you, my friends, is if you're going to spend that money and if you're going to take the time and effort to actually record podcasts, spend the $20 a month that's required and put it on a podcast feed where you pay for it, like Libsyn, SoundCloud, etc., so that they're putting your content out onto every possible feed, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, et cetera. I actually have one organization that I know that started a podcast. It's on SoundCloud, but they're unwilling to pay the $20 or $25 or however much it costs a month to get it out on anything but SoundCloud. And consequently, they only get about 50 or 60 listeners per episode. And the reason is every time an episode releases, first of all, they have to tell all their audience, hey, an episode's released. And then instead of it being seamless and frictionless, instead of someone just being able to pick up their phone and go, oh, that's the one I want to listen to, let me listen to it, the individual actually has to go to SoundCloud, open up the web browser, listen to it, close the web browser. And that's more work than most people will do. So if you're going to go to all this work and all this expense, go ahead and drop the $20, $25 a month to have a service like Libsyn or SoundCloud host your podcast. All right. I think that's my answer on that.
Great. Do we have time for one more?
Maybe one more. I think we're at about 24, 25 minutes.
Okay. So this last question, Dolph, has a little bit of a story. So, you know, we do Ask Dolph Live webinars where folks can come and ask questions and we'll have a conversation right there about whatever's going on. And it's really nice because, Dolph, you can ask a lot of clarifying questions and make sure folks get exactly the answers that they need. So this actually comes from an Ask Dolph Live, but we uninvited the folks that asked it.
That's and, awesome.
Yeah. So we usually skim through to see who's joining us on our webinars. And very rarely we run into an organization that does not share the same values we do. And this was a case where I don't know how much I can share. It was an organization that
It was a forced birth organization. It was an organization that opposes a woman's right to make reproductive health care decisions for herself, including, quite frankly, getting an abortion.
And shared a lot of false information as well. So, yeah. So we uninvited them. But they had a good question, and so I thought I'd share it here. What is your advice, Dolph, for building and maintaining partnerships with other nonprofits?
So that can be so tough for so many organizations, in part because when we talk about building and maintaining relationships, we're talking also about turf and we're talking about money. And that can be really hard. I mean, as much as we like to think of ourselves as being collaborative and cooperative in the nonprofit sector, so often, you know, we all want to know, well, who's going to be in charge? And, you know, if there is a dollar to be made, how is that dollar going to be split? Can I somehow shift all that dollar to me? Is the other person, other organization trying to shift it all to them? How are we going to split it? And so the biggest piece of advice that I have is to make sure you think through exactly how your partnership is going to work. And that includes money. That includes turf. It also, let me say, includes intellectual property. It includes contact lists. Like literally, like everything that may have value to you as an organization, you need to negotiate that and get it all in writing, upfront and clear. And the document also needs to be very clear about how disputes will be resolved. You know, so are you first going to try to work it out? Okay, then put that in there and put some teeth in there that, you know, that to make it very clear that the two organizations first have to sit down to work it out. And who is that? Are you going to go to mediation or arbitration if you can't work it out one-on-one? And if so, what does that look like? How is the mediator or arbitrator actually selected? Could you go to court and how? But make sure that you think through everything that could possibly go wrong in your partnership and your relationship with this new organization. And in thinking through that, that will also help you have, and as you start to work on this agreement, it will help you have conversations with the other organization. Hey, how are we going to handle our contact lists? Who ultimately is going to own the people that sign up for this one-time email campaign that we're doing to get out the vote or whatever? Who's going to own those names and why? So really working through all of that so that the partnership then can just be implemented and implemented smoothly. And if it doesn't work out, you know exactly what you are owed as you exit the partnership.
I think another thing to think about is what are you hoping to get from this partnership? You know, there's I think a lot of what you're talking about are some really detailed, intentional, collaborative work. And there's tons of examples of really healthy coalitions, you know, as an example, that are doing great work together. But there's also sometimes organizations are looking more for something like a mentor. And we do some work around that when we do our strategic planning, and we help the organizations we're doing strategic planning with identify a learning journey partner. And we usually are looking for somebody on the other side of the country, or at least far outside of turf, because that's certainly an issue. And we go visit and we spend time getting to know this organization. But ultimately, our hope is that they'll continue talking to each other and working together and sharing ideas and sharing, you know, what are pain points and some ways we can get over those pain points. And then that's more of a, I guess, more of an informal relationship, but can be really beneficial, especially as an organization is asking itself some big questions about its future and you know, strategies to get where it needs to go.
Alexia, I really appreciate you taking us from the tactical up to the 30,000 feet. Thank you.
Anytime, Dolph.
All right. I think you said that was going to be our last question.
It is.
Lexi, thank you. I am so glad that we were able to do this mailbag episode together. And I just realized you and I have spent pretty much the entire morning together. It's about quarter to noon now. We started at 9 a.m. Whenever I do an interim executive director engagement, when it's over, you always do an evaluation. So you gave me my evaluation earlier, and then we've done a couple mailbag episodes. It's been great spending the morning with you in your beautiful, beautiful new home.
Thank you, Dolph. It's been a good morning. It was a good way to start the week.
Yes, it was, and a super short week for you, super short week for me, because I leave for sabbatical at the end of this week. But Lexi, thank you so much. As always, I'm so grateful to be able to work with you. I've made a lot of knuckleheaded decisions in my career, but I've made a couple good ones, and one of the best ones I've made is working with you, and I'm always grateful that you actively choose to work with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Dolph. You're making me blush.
All right. Well, friends, I hope that you have enjoyed this episode. And if you have, please consider forwarding it to a friend, a colleague, or a board member. That, my friends, is our show for the week. I hope that you have gained some insight to help you and your nonprofit thrive. And I almost ended this without doing the disclaimer. And Lexi reminded me I forgot to do the disclaimer. So now it's both Lexi and the lawyers who are on me about doing this disclaimer. So I'm not an accountant nor an attorney. And neither I nor the Goldenberg Group provide tax, legal, or accounting advice. This means just exactly what you think it does, that this show is for informational purposes only and should not be relied on for
tax, legal, or accounting advice.
Oh my gosh, perfect. I did not know you were going to fill it in. I was hoping listeners would fill it in their head, and that's awesome. Thank you, Lexi.